Okay.
We are 10 seconds beyond 9:30, and the good lady said I can begin. Today is Monday, May 25th, 2020. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we're all together. The news across the world is a little bit better. And Nekavelatov. Here, there's no mention of Corona whatsoever, but they give us statistics from across the world. I want to say Boker Tov Mevorach to the students in front of me and to all those listening across the wide expanse of Jewish existence. I want to mention Rabbi Grinstein, a topic we've been discussing. So evidently, it looks to me like these are from the archives of Chief Rabbi Herzog. This is the original sheet for the first Yom HaTzmaut 1949, what the Chief Rabbinate proposed. And compared to what we do today, it's very simple. Aleph, Ein Omrim Tachman. Bet, Be Tfilat Shachrit Omrim Hallel Beli Bracha. And three, Marbim Besuda, the Zimra, Umatanot Le'avyonim. And the question is, why Matanot Le'avyonim? So I said very simply, if you go back to 1949, the country was in the height of the Tsena, the height of poverty. People came in, the Mabarat, we all know the history. So I imagine this was a way to give tzedakah, just like we give the Matanot Le'avyonim on Purim. They wanted to encourage tzedakah as well on Yom HaTzmaut. But it's a very, very interesting document. Okay, I want to pick up where I left off, and I have one additional addendum that I want to thank Jack Levinwal for sending it to me. There's no question that the problem of the Aguna has haunted us in various forms for hundreds and hundreds of years, if not on to 2,000 years already. It could even be more. Chayalei Beit David already called Fin Gitnin Vinesheichem. So right there you see the problem. And in modern times, we have a new aguna, an aguna that we never dreamt about, where a man is holding up a woman, torturing a woman for money, generally speaking. I don't want to be corrected. I know that there are cases in reverse. I've had them. I've had them with students, and I know exactly that they're agunim as well. But percentage-wise, I would say 90% of the cases are agunat and not agunim. And the conservative rabbi, which has this approach that Judaism is man-centered, not God-centered, we can make takanot, we can make amendments, we can come up with ideas that will solve problems. And there's a long history as early as 1930. I mentioned it last week. Rabbi Epstein of Brookline, of Boston area, he was the first one, well-known conservative rabbi, European trained, certainly a bit of a Talmud Chacham, and he came up with the proposal, the night of the marriage, to authorize again. It was a serious proposal. He wrote a sefer about it. There were two sefarim written against him. Rav Kook got involved. I lectured on it years ago for many, many weeks. As time moved on, that proved impossible for obvious reasons. Wedding night, you're going to authorize a get. Who do you authorize? Who are the shluchim? Who are the edim? Who is the sofa? And even if you mention names, who has a cheskat chayim? We're alive now. Who knows what will be 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? All right. There were various addendums to try to solve that problem. But following World War II, the conservative movement was really feeling big and powerful. It was their time of manifold extension and expansion. As I've said many times, it was the perfect American Judaism. What do I mean by that? America's the melting pot. And you have on one hand the great melting pot, on the other hand, the ethnic multiplicity. This is what America's famous for. And orthodoxy, too ethnic. Reform, too melted. Conservative Judaism, perfect. The synthesis between the ethnic multiplicity and the melting pot. And the rabbis were demanding a solution. They felt it's a disgrace for Judaism that we can't solve all problems, underline the word all. And they came up with the conservative ketubah, the famous ketubah that we're now discussing. It was proposed in the early 50s. It's generally called the Professor Liebman's ketubah. He actually didn't originate it. It's Max Arts. But because he fine-tuned it and put his prestige behind it, it's called the conservative ketubah, the Liebman Clause, and they give Professor Shaul Liebman the credit. I mentioned when the ketubah came out, before we got involved with the Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb's critique, I mentioned that there was a little booklet put out by Yeshiva University, an article by Eliel Levin and Meir Kramer, showing legally it would be impossible to uphold the conservative clause in an American court, separation of church and state. So Jack Leventhal showed me the New York Times. The article is from February 16, 1983. It's quite a few years ago, 37 years ago, that there was a case where the court upheld the conservative ketubah. I wonder if this was appealed later. I wonder what happened. I wonder if there are other examples. But the court ruled, the New York State Court of Appeals ruled by 4-3 that the marriage contracts of ketubot, which are signed by Orthodox and conservative Jews, are binding civil contracts as well as religious covenants. And the majority opinion was written by a Jewish judge, Sal Wachtla, wrote for the majority, I quote, that the obligations undertaken by the parties to the ketubah are grounded in religious belief and practice and does not preclude enforcement of its secular terms. And this is very fascinating because what it's saying, this was the tremendous argument that ultimately in some of the states, we now have some support for yeshiva day schools. What do I mean by this? You can turn to the government and say, support the yeshiva curriculum. It's state and religion. They can't interact. Zelichud v'zelichud, each one is separate. But we have to help the children. This is not the school. This is not the curriculum. Buses, we have to get the children to school. Children who have disability and need special type of help and special type of buses and special type of supervision. You're helping the child, not just the school. And it's taken many years. You have to give credit to Agudat Yisrael. You have to give credit to the Union of Orthodox Congregations, to their legal staffs. Certainly in the New York area and elsewhere, there is substantial help from the federal government. Now, with the ketubah, what Judge Wachtla is saying is that there's a difference between the religious parts of the ketubah, that the man obligates himself to support his wife in accordance with the Torah, she obligates herself to have relations with her husband, etc., etc. Those are religious concepts. But as far as money and appearing before a court, that's a secular concept, and the state has to enforce it. Very interesting. What's also interesting is this case is sad. Evidently, it's a lady who's an Israeli, Susan Roe Avitzua, or married an Israeli. It's an American girl, evidently, who married an Israeli. His name was Boaz Avitzur. They were married in Westbury, Long Island in 1966. She was granted, Miss Avitzur was granted a civil divorce on the ground of cruel and inhuman treatment, but he refused his wife's requests to receive a get. And then she subsequently sued him for breach of contract because they had this conservative ketubah. And this was the ruling of the Supreme Court. That's many years later. I hope and trust that she got a get. And who knows if over the years we didn't interact with her children and grandchildren. All right, but it would be interesting to know if there are other cases where it was successfully upheld by the secular courts. Now let's come to Normie Lamb's article. If you remember, I ended off the class last week by quoting to you the conservative clause. It's an addendum to the ketubah. It states, I can requote it, and in solemn assent to the mutual responsibilities and love, the Hatan v'Kala have declared as evidence of our desire to enable each other to live in accordance with the Jewish law of marriage throughout our lifetime. And it goes on to say, we, the bride and groom, attach our signatures to this ketubah and hereby agree to recognize the Beit Din of the Rabbinical Assembly and the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. And whatever the Beit Din will rule, we will follow, and if there is a problem, we authorize the Beit Din to impose such terms of compensation as it may see fit for failure to respond to its summons or to carry out its decision. So in Hebrew, this actual one paragraph, the Liebman clause, is actually three different paragraphs. In the first paragraph, it speaks about the husband and wife agreeing to live in accordance with Judaism, accordance with tradition. The second paragraph speaks about the importance of the Beit Din of the conservative movement. And the third paragraph, which is really the most innovative part, is that the Beit Din will have the right to fine the individuals. Fine. Gentlemen, to be absolutely honest, when you look at this conservative clause, what's wrong with it? As I mentioned to you, look into Shulchan Aruch Eben Ezra. You're going to find many different simanim about many different ketubot. Each country had its own minhagim. Do you know that when you get married in Israel, they give you a choice, Ashkenazi ketubah, Eidot HaMizrach ketubah? Look into it. The Yerushalayim ketubah. How many of you have seen a wedding in Yerushalayim and looked at the ketubah? You'll notice about 7-8 sentences are bracketed. You know why they're bracketed? Because that's the original nusach of the ketubah that you agree that you're going to live in Yerushalayim, you're going to buy a house, you're not going to take another wife, etc., etc. All right, nowadays we don't enforce that part of the Torah. We don't read it. It's there. Those who want it can do it. Those who don't want it, when my middle daughter writes ketubot, so she never writes in that part. That part is always left out. But there's so many different variations. What are we dealing with here? We're not dealing here with Chometz D'Oraita. We're not dealing here with Issa Shabbos D'Oraita, carrying a glass case on Shabbos with glasses in it, what we spoke about yesterday. We're dealing with protection of the lady. That's what a ketubah is about. So what's wrong with this conservative ketubah? The feeling was, and you'll see this comes across in a minute fashion in Rabbi Lam's critique. It comes across much stronger when you go through Harpades, you follow the Israeli newspapers at the time. It was viewed as the conservative movement taking advantage of their strength to conquer American Judaism or Western world Judaism. We are the authorities. We know what we're doing. We are determined to save Torah. We are not reform. On the other hand, we're not going to be like the Orthodox who don't feel like innovating to save poor, innocent ladies who are terrorized by their husbands, who will not give them a get, who are demanding money, who are demanding other benefits in a divorce agreement. And more than anything, this was the way the counter-reaction took place. Listen to my words very carefully, because you'll see what comes out of this, the joint based in. You have to understand the inner workings. The idea, not so terrible. Will the court enforce it? Won't the court enforce it? Not the end of the world. I told you last week, the example I gave you is a beautiful example of a business. I know all the people who are in the business, who survived from the business, the grandchildren. I know tens and tens of people from this family. And the grandparents wanted to make a statement. Whether, remember they said, if the business should ever be Machalo Shabbos, it must be sold and all the money given to Orthodox Torah Stuckot. And maybe even put in that the OU has to decide how to divide up the money. These people were very active and are still active in the OU and REITs, etc. All right, I don't know if there's a secular court in America that can enforce it, but they made a statement. Here too, the fear was they're making a statement. We're conquering the world. Every little Orthodox shul across the United States, I should say even big Orthodox shuls, 50s, one mechitza came down after another. One mechitza, millions of Jews have been lost to Yiddishkeit as a result of the silent spiritual Holocaust that we have as a result of the breakdown of religious observance. But in the 50s, they were riding high. You can drive the shul on Shabbos. Men and women are equal. Men and women go to university. We don't put women behind the stone wall. I can show you time and again what was said. We speak a proper English. You can be proud of us as rabbis. We are the ultimate of what Torah is about. Ethnic multiplicity and the melting pot of America. And this was the tremendous fear. And part of Rabbi Lam's article is a tremendous attack. What kind of baitin? I'll quote his words in a minute. How can you have a baitin if there's not surrendered to Torah? If these are not dayanim, yireim, shleimim, what are we talking about here? And the article is quite long, quite learned, and it takes apart all three divisions of the Lieberman Clause. Number one, there's a whole analysis of the ketubah. What is the ketubah? What do we mean by a ketubah? And it represents in its very legalism the deep concern of our rabbis for the protection and honor of the women, and consequently for the inviolate sanctity of the Jewish home. It is a kind of combined life insurance policy and alimony guarantee. It protects the woman's financial status at a time when she is in a most precarious personal and economic condition. And goes on to explain what the ketubah accomplishes. The original ketubah, what you give a lady, 200 zuz, the tosefta, which depends upon the generosity of the man, covering the dowry. This is all in our ketuvah. Now, I don't have to tell you, nowadays with the feminist movement, I have seen rabbis, I have seen weddings with my own eyes of talmidim of mine, where he gives a ketuvah and she gives a ketuvah. The women are, look at it, what, you got to guarantee today, the women, there's some women, I was talking with my daughter about a couple, she's now a Sabim and Shelet Yisrael, we have 34 Sarim. By the way, if you do your homework, you're going to find out that the majority of the Sarim are Shomrei and Shomrat Shabbat today. It's an amazing thing. So Dafka, one of the Sarim I'm related to through marriage, and I was talking to my daughters, they're both in this profession, lawyers, etc. But he's the one who stays at home, and she's the one who works. And there are many couples like that today. They see who has certain abilities. I can give a long list of names, famous women. You never hear about the husband. And they're happily married. Don't misunderstand me. At one time, every Israeli woman who was successful in politics, Geula Cohn couldn't sustain a marriage. Lima Levnat couldn't sustain a marriage. You can go on and on. And today, yeah, women, look at Miri Regev, Kol HaKavod Lah. I'm a great fan of Miri Regev. What a dynamo. And Baruch Hashem, happily married, Gila Gamliel, Chatovetsky, your friend from Rehovot. You can go on and on. Chatabeli, right? Let me pronounce it right. Correct me if I'm wrong. This time I got it right. Okay. So you see, here in the 1950s, no one dreamt there'll ever be a time where a woman would give the ketuvah to a man. And they insist, you have no idea, I'm talking, I don't want to mention names, but what I've seen in my life already, okay? I'm a fanatic, I'm a traditionalist, I have to admit it, I'm not one in favor of innovation. I'm a Sada Kedushin, and a few years, a grandson, so her family is Torah V'Avoda, they're part of the innovators, and they wanted me to read a Kitzur Ketuvah under the chuppah. So I told them, look, I can't do it. When I'm a Sada Kedushin, Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik is standing next to me. I cannot do anything that he would not approve of. But all right, they have a case. You're reading it in Aramaic. Who understands the Aramaic? I was a Sada Kedushin a few months earlier, maybe a year ago, my grandson. So there, the Ketuvah was read by one of his Rebbeim from the new, or one of her Rebbeim from the new world of Torah V'Avoda, Lagmata Kodesh. Before I could say Jackie Robinson, he's reading an abridged Hebrew version of the Ketuvah. And a frum guy with a big beard and a big kippah from God. But all right, that's their thinking. They're innovating with the language that people understand. I'm not here to argue with them, but I can't change my gestalt. To me, any innovation, I shiver, I shake. I saw the rub up close. All right, I have a right to follow my Rebbe. But his description of the Ketuvah, at that time you can tell it's apologetic, that he wants them to understand we rabbis always cared about women. That the hefet, who ever heard of giving a woman a life insurance policy? And those of you have seen when I'm a Sada Kedushin, if I know what I'm doing, Baruch Hashem, I always laugh that people, Rabbanim, who come over to me, wow, what you did, now you understand. Bani Shlalem, if you're Masada Kedushin, you got to know what you're doing. So I always, Glimadi al Ktafai, Bachayai Bebein Achachayai, say to the Chatan, do you realize what you're signing here? See, the trouble is, it's in Aramaic. It's Klingsich Nishnitem, yeah. So if it's English, I say, I tell it to him in English. If it's in here, if it's he's a Hebrew speaker, I tell it to him in Hebrew. Whether you're alive or dead, the shirt off your back, you're responsible to this lady you're taking as your wife, and understand what you're signing. So all right, he's absolutely right, and it's a beautiful document, and it's here to protect and honor the woman. Okay. Then he goes on to analyze clause by clause. And he says, look what you're saying, the Ketuvah. in the conservative ktuvah, in the addendum, that you conduct themselves all the days of their life in the way of Torah. In other words, they want to lead into the fact that they're obligated to JTS, to the and to RA, the Rabbinic Assembly. No, to conduct yourself all the days of your life in the way of Torah. Gentlemen, let's say for the sake of argument, there were 100,000 conservative rabbis performing weddings, 100,000 such weddings in the early 50s, the mid 50s. What percentage came out of those weddings? Shomrei Kashrut, Shomrei Shabbat. What are we talking about? Conduct yourself in the ways of Torah. So Rabbi Lamb makes the point that this very clause, this first concept or first clause, part of the Liebman addendum, you're not protecting the wife. You're putting the wife in a position where the man can say, well, the first meal we ate after we got married that she cooked, prepared, was non-kosher. If it was non-kosher, she's not conducting herself in the ways of Jewish tradition. The whole ketubah is worthless. I owe her nothing. She has transgressed the very first clause. And of course, Rabbi Lamb goes on, it negates the entire intention of the ketubah, which is for the protection of the woman. All right, it's a critique. Again, I'm not going to lose sleep over the critique. We can explain what it means, Jewish life, as she understands it. If a guy named Rakefet can spend months at a time on Reb Moshe's concept of Geirut, what was in Europe, what was in America, with Hamitkaer Ben Ha'akum, and he didn't know there was Shabbos in the world, this can melamed zchut zayin on the Ketubah as well. But this is the first part of the critique. The second part is you're agreeing to go to Beit Din, and what does this mean? You agree to go to Beit Din. How can you obligate yourself? This is an intangible concept. It's not something that you really can grasp, that you really can put your hands on. So, all right. You will say, do a Kinyan Suda. What are we doing a Kinyan Suda at a wedding? The Chatan obligates himself. The financial aspects of the Ketuvah. Find there a Kinyan Suda. In short, there must be an objective reality at which we aim the subjective effect of the Kinyan. All right, that we can understand. He takes the Suda, he holds the Suda, and he's obligating himself, even though he knows that it's money, he doesn't know exactly what, but there is something that he can understand. To go to a Beit Din, it's the Barim B'Alma. What is it saying to him? It doesn't speak to him. You simply cannot perform a kinyan on a matter which is objectively insubstantial. To recognize as a mental process, and you must have something that he recognizes that he can touch. The Beit Din, a later date, it's not real to him. How can you say you're going to obligate yourself? All right, he develops a very nice critique. Once again, I have to say, you're not going to lose sleep over it, all right? So it's not a total obligation, but if he winds up at the Beit Din and social pressures put on him, mehecha teisei, don't make an issue out of it. We're trying to save women in a very difficult situation. The third part, and here, of course, is the biggest critique of all, and those of you that follow what's happened in the 70 years, on to 70 years, since all this took place, this issue comes up time and again. Asmachta lo kanya. Vic, have you ever been to Las Vegas? You ever see what goes on there in the hotels? Gambling, gambling, gambling. You get off the plane. I've been to Las Vegas quite a few times. I have a brother living there. I was not there to gamble. Take my word for it. I'm a scholar in residence. I visited my brother. You get off in the airport. Has anyone been to, I'd like someone to certify what I'm saying. You shouldn't think I'm making it up. In the airport. Gambling, all right, at least Jay is shaking his head, yes. In the airport, there are all types of gambling machines. David Goldis is shaking his head, yes. Baruch Hashem, the hotel. Not only that, you have areas, the select areas, those are the high gamblers, the big gamblers. And boy, what these eyes saw, sitting in the select areas where women who I would say are more nude than their clothes are serving drinks and cocktails. Ich hab gesehen Hasidische Yidden sitzen dort mit langer Bart, with black clothes. And these guys, they're looking at Rakefet, they can buy me and sell me in 1 minute flat. No, what's this? Oh, a guy wants to gamble away $10,000 a shot. What's wrong? Chaim, what's wrong with it? Guy can gamble away, do what he wants. Nachum, this is Mesachek Bekukya. The whole Sugya in Sanhedrin, if your life is just gambling, you are a thief. Because Asmachta lo kanya. And you all know the Sugya is, it's very clear, it's common sense. When I'm gambling, I don't believe I'm going to lose. I'm putting up $100, I'm putting it out because I'm convinced I'm going to win. Then you take away my $100, you're robbing me. I'm not really giving it to you, belay the nefesh. I lost, and all right, the whole sugya, if you're a gambler, if you're kashal eidot, how much you have to gamble, if it's your main profession, a side profession. But look what you're saying here. You're saying here to a couple getting married who are in love, I hope, and nothing can harm them, nothing will be wrong with them. They're going to go on a happy, wonderful life. And Ribbono Shel Olam, they're going to be throwing dishes at each other, and they're going to go to a rabbinic court, and the rabbinic court is going to obligate him to pay her for every day that he doesn't give her a get. This is Asmachta. This is like Las Vegas. It's a gambling table. This is not real. This, by the way, was one of the big critiques of Rabbi Louis Epstein's proposal to write a, to give an authorization for a get at the night of the wedding. Guy's getting married. He's walking on air. He's in love. I hope I'm not overstating the case. Baruch Hashem. And you think he's giving authorization to write a get? He really thinks he's going to give a get? He really thinks that marriage is going to break up like that? What kind of authorization? And here, asmachta, money, going, you'll be fine. It's asmachta lo kanya. The whole concept is invalid. Certainly, therefore, our case on the same principle invalid. Here, the bride and groom obligate themselves to pay at the demand of the Beitin, penalties of undetermined sums. And you can look into the Rambam Hilchot Mechira. By the way, I'm making a correction here. There's a mistaken tradition. It's Perek Yud Aleph, Halacha Tetzayin, 1116. Here it says 1115. There are always mistakes like that. Because when you're proofreading, what's the difference? 1115, 1116. You take for granted it's correct. But look it up and you'll see the Rambam talks about someone obligating himself to support you for 5 years. Asmachta lo kanya, you can never take him to court because 5 years, he doesn't know the sum. He doesn't know how much money it's going to cost. He doesn't know what's involved. It's an asmachta. Alacha kama bakama, when you talk about a beitin that's not tangible and not real, and it's a sum of money that's not tangible and not real, and not even a sum that you can talk about, how can you make a kinyan? How can you obligate yourself? Put in back of your minds what I'll come to next week afterwards. This is why the prenups we have today all have sums of money. I'll show that to you, various sums. But here, it's an asmachta because it's not black and white. And this is Rabbi Lamb's analysis. And he says, I can quote to you the conclusion of the article and then many footnotes. In summary, we have analyzed the three parts of the proposed conservative takana and found that the first is not only superfluous, but can actually prove prejudicial to the interest of the wife, whose protection the takana ostensibly seeks to enhance. It's what I told you. She'll serve him a treif meal. He owes her nothing. She broke the first commitment to live in accordance with tradition. The second is invalid because the subject matter is objectively too insubstantial to be legally contracted. You're going to say, I'm going to go to a beitin. What beitin? When beitin? You don't know what a beitin means. Rabbinic assembly, JTS. The third, by nature so vague and indeterminate that it fails to satisfy the minimal subjective requirements for valid contracts. And that's asmachta lo kanya. That's gambling. You don't believe you're going to lose. When you do lose, I don't have to tell you, psychologically, you're being robbed by the other person. At the end of the article, becomes what ultimately is viewed as the main point in Torah opposition. Let us emphasize once again that we have dealt with the conservative amendment only as a problem in the halachic validity of contracts. True issues of far greater consequence have not been treated at all. The acceptance of a non-orthodox beitin, which presumes to render a halachic decision while representing a movement whose philosophical approach to the halacha is decidedly negative, at best ambiguous. So one tremendous problem. You're turning around and all of American life will center around the Beitin of JTS, R.A., a Beitin. Who are they? What are they? What is their commitment? What have they paskened in the past? Abolish second day yontif, drink non-kosher wine, use electricity on Shabbos. What are we talking about? This is a beitin, this is halacha, number one. And number two, he doesn't address the other problem, which is a problem that haunts us until today. Get me'usa. All of you know, tremendous sugya in Masechet Gittin. Person has to give a get out of his full will, his full feeling. No one can force him. Could be Jews can force him. What does the Gemara say? What does the Gemara say in Gittin? Makin oto ad she'omer rotzani. But it's a Jewish baiten that beats the hell out of him. May a kahana at times indulge in such activities. Satna has a goon squad, which I hope still acts until today. I know people that contacted them, and boy, was it get given quickly. And there was some unwritten relationship with the civil authorities in New York City that they didn't investigate too much when a guy was found stretched out in a Jewish cemetery in Staten Island with black and blue marks all over. Boy, did he rush to give a get within the time allotted before they would say hello to him again. But the get musar, goyim, a goyish beit din, a goyish court, absolutely not allowed. It's goyim. Again, you know the Rambam, and I don't want to go into all the detail here, but the Rambam raises the very issue. How can you beat the hell out of a guy and he'll give a get? If it's a get musa, but he says every Jew deep down wants to do good. This is what this is based upon. Get rid of the klipot, the outside klipot, and you'll be able to get to the good Jew who's really hiding in the body. So when Jews beat the hell out of him, they return him to his primitive state of beauty and joy on being a Jew. He gives the get. But Goyim, what does Goyim have to do with Yiddishkeit? A get musar is not kasher. And here, look what you're doing. You're turning to the Gentile courts. They have to enforce the get. They have to sue the man. They have to enforce what the Beit Din of JTS is doing. And he's giving a get, not because of Torah. He's giving a get because he's being forced, financially coerced. Okay, get Musa. Tell me, in the state of Israel, we have the same problem, do we or don't we? You can throw a person into court, into jail today for not giving you get. By the way, the same law applies to women. That was something my daughter, I told you many times, my daughter was involved in changing the law because there were cases of men. The women said, we're not taking you get, go hang yourself. And these were religious men who didn't want to take a pilegish, they wanted to remarry kedat v'kedin. But basically 90% of the time, it's the woman who suffers, not the man. And you can throw a man, he loses, you have all types of rules and regulations. He can't get a license to practice medicine, he can't get a license to practice law, he can't have a checking account, he can't have a bank account, he can't get a passport, he can't leave the country. And if that doesn't work, you can throw him into jail. And if that doesn't work now, you can throw him into bidud, into solitary confinement in jail. Wow. Here? But it's Jews that are forcing. And there we go back to the Rambam. It's not a get musa. It's uncovering, getting rid of the klipot, getting back to the original man who was decent, who was Jewish, who has not been ruined by life and by secular literature and by the New York Times, etc. Okay, this is a very interesting problem, get musa. Vic, you know, it comes up in modern times, the get law in New York. Tell me, you have friends in Borough Park, your father, your brothers are rub in Borough Park, you have a sister living in Flatbush. They have many friends who don't accept the get law. You know why they don't accept it? Because they say it's get musa. It's the, and there's truth to it. It's not Israel. It's America. It's Gentiles. Get musa. Okay. So this was Rabbi Lamb's critique. When all is said and done, I wouldn't lose sleep over the first part of the clause. We know they eat treif. We know they don't know what Shabbat is. Okay, not the end of the world. We got to deal with reality. We mean to observe Judaism that they'll listen to the conservative rabbinate. The second clause, going to the Beit Din, that is really the heart of the critique. It rang all over the world. Who are these people? What do they know about Yiddishkeit? What do they know about Torah? What do they care about Torah? They've been matir so many Yisurim. Even though we're talking 1950s, we're not talking today when there's no conservative movement at all in the sense of commitment to tradition and Torah. But already then, this is a baiting. They're going to become the arbiters. They're going to become the rabbanim responsible for proper halachic standards in Jewish marriages. That is a loud, loud critique. The third part, maybe we'll find a solution, which ultimately we do. Yes, asmachta lo kanya, but maybe this is a wise idea. People love money. I don't have to tell you. Any intelligent person, we have to be told to love God with all your money. If we're told to love God with all your soul, with all your heart, the most important parts of your existence. But what did Chazal say already? Chazal knew human beings. They're people that their money is more important to them than any other facet of their existence. And believe me, I've seen that in life too. I once lived with my family, with a daughter where she was living, and with big din Torah, and the person who brought it, people couldn't believe that. They told me, oh, we know this man. He's so nice. He's so kind. I said, yeah, you know him in normal existence. When it comes to money, wow, how people change. Sometimes it's frightening, but that's the reality. We'll leave it at that. By the way, that little story I told you just now had a tremendous impact on my family, because the case went from Beit Din to the Beit Din HaGadol, because all the people involved were frum. And my daughter saw the workings of the Batei Dinim. She was one of the tenants involved. And right after that case, she was working for her master's at Hebrew U in English Literature, teaching at Horev. And right after that case, she saw an advertisement: if you are a lady who has graduated college and you know how to learn a Daf Gemara on your own, and you are religious, we have a new program opening, Toenet Rabbani. And she signed up for the program, and she was the first graduate. And later she went to Hebrew law school, where she saw she needed both in Israel. But money is money. Ah, money can frighten people. Give her a get already. Why should I have to pay the witch $1,000 a day? All right, with all the critiques, the middle one is the one that rings the loudest and clearest. Gentlemen, I miss my microphone. Morty, I still haven't solved that problem, but I hope we'll get back to normal existence when the new year opens. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam, Mashiach Kol Yevad Vara. Gentlemen, I was old enough to know a little bit of the inner workings of the seminary at that time. And here I have to tell you, I salute with zest someone named the young man that has to be Benjamin Steiner. Benjamin Steiner published in the American Jewish Archives Journal. It's 2017. the number one journal published that year, the year 2017, the Lieberman Clause Revisited. And you have no idea how much nachat I had from this scholarly article. Who Benjamin Steiner is, I don't know him personally. I think I saw something that he's affiliated with Brandeis University. Let me just check if I see. Yeah, third year doctoral student in the Near Eastern and Judaic Studies Department in Brandeis University. And evidently he's done some serious scholarship on the conservative movement. This article takes you into the conservative mindset. And now I'll be able to prove every word I said last week was correct. What was happening at that time in the conservative movement, a tremendous split was developing, literally a chasm between the student body and the teachers. I'll pay credit to Yeshiva University as I knew it, and I hope still know it. I don't know what the future holds. They have very, as you realize, the problem with the gays is very serious. But I'll pay credit to Yeshiva University. Although I was an American kid, third generation American, although my parents were born and bred in Harlem, although my father played sandlot baseball with Hank Greenberg, Tritona Park, they lived around the corner from each other. They were a year apart. My father was 1 year older than Hank. I went to yeshiva. I loved my rebbeim. I worshiped the ground they walked on. My rebbeim, who are we talking about? Reb Mendel Zaks, Abgeret Avot in English? Ich hab nicht gehört. I never heard Reb Mendel Zaks speak English. Reb Leizer Volk, all right, he spoke a little English. He was in Tells, he never left Tells. Reb Yerushim Gerelik, I don't have to tell you. Volcano let loose. Reb Noach Bornstein, the Brisker Reb's greatest talent, Abashbundener, lost in America, could write a novel about him. Lost in America. The Reb, with all his greatness, his English had an accent. He was an American, no two ways about it, but he wasn't the Yankee. He didn't come on the Mayflower. And nevertheless, I saw through all my rebbeim. I kissed the ground they walked on, and I even prepared thousands of sheets awaiting in my Gris office and my file cabinets on the Europäische Yeshiva. I went back to where they came from, and God had privileged me to keep me in health, to give all those shermats, so much I want to accomplish. But it's Rav Hashem, the conservative rabbinate, they were conquering America. They were riding high. Shul after shul, temple after temple fell to them. One mechitza after another pulled down in dignity, in my opinion. The faculty of the seminary, old-fashioned, outmodish, outlandish. Europeans, what do they know about America? There was a tremendous breach here. There's more to the story. Those of you that have heard, a guy named Rakefetz spent over the decades many lectures. What's the difference between a yeshiva and a seminary? A yeshiva, how do we succeed? How do you measure our success? We create a new generation. We're the happiest Rebbeim alive to see our students smarter than us and more learned than us and greater in Shas and Paiskine, but Chazal put it in Avmakanebi, the Novin, Rav Makanebi, tell me go. There are tomorrow. It's our greatest love, joy, satisfaction that I still have Talmidim from 59 on, who are my closest friends. My closest friends. That's a Rebbe. A seminary, you're a professor. You want to produce scholarship. The students, that's a way to make a living. But your main thrust, your main interest, your main concern, scholarship. No, do I have to open Washington for you? Washington, 530 pages, perhaps. Forget them all. Just go to one or two pages where I describe the Rav's classroom, 57, 58. Rabbi Radin, the leading conservative rabbi in the Washington Heights Inwood area. Inwood was adjacent to Washington Heights. It's 2-3 blocks away. Ah, big temple there. Rabbi Radin was the rabbi. And he started coming to the Rav Shurim, sat with us, one of the boys. And one time after Shir, I capture a moment in time, but a moment that says so much. He said, fellas, you know, I've studied with Professor Lieberman. Now I study with the Rav. The Rav loved him, by the way. You want to know the difference between them? And we jump forward. Wow. What will he say? And boy, did he say it. He said, look at the Rav. You never seen without students. Comes to class. Students meet him crossing the street from his mother's apartment. They walk with him. He never finished on time in his life. 10 minutes longer, 20 minutes longer, 30 minutes longer. No one had the chutzpah to tell the Rav, Rebbe, your time is over. After class, they don't let him leave. They're talking with him, walking back. He's walking to the subway. Six students are around him in a semicircle. I was one of them. You know, look at Professor Lieberman. He came in a few minutes late. Finished the class, made a beehive back to his study. You didn't see him, gave two classes a week, the rest of the week working away on his monumental Parish Tosefta Kapshita. This was Professor Lieberman. His life, his writings, the Meiri, who put them out, all the edited editions, Rabbi Sofer taught at the seminary. You never saw him. Back working on the Meiri. And you can go right down the line. A seminary is like a university. Scholarship, publication. Students are only incidental. And this was what's happening at the seminary. I'll quote every word I'm saying, I'll give you sources. The rabbis were out in the field. They wanted reform. The people need guidance, innovation, make Judaism a little easier, so we'll hold on to them. The students being raised already post-World War II. Who wants all these restrictions? It's a new world, me. Dr. Kefford spoke about why God, Corona, waking us up that there's a God, the world, communist China, that was a, listen to that talk again. Don't read the Jewish press, what they did to my talk. Oh my gosh. Gave me, the Turakata ought to send me a membership card now. So, okay. The faculty, they had nothing to do with the students. They were committed to Dvar Hashem, Zu Halacha. Outside of Mordechai Kaplan, there wasn't one member of the rabbinical faculty who was orthoprax and basically orthodox. And the students lost contact. It's like a chasm. They're going one way and they're standing still. And this conservative ketuvah becomes a point of challenge, a point of controversy, right in the seminary itself. And it's sort of an overture for all that's going to happen in the seminary. And ultimately, the seminary can be summarized by one thought from Chazal, Matai Yamutu Oto Sekanim. When will they finally die? When can we finally succeed them? The minute Professor Lieberman died, that ended conservative Judaism. As far as Torah and tradition, as far as real basic commitment, as far as trying to be a continuation within the Western world of what they viewed as Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh. But the process is already beginning. And I said it to you last week, and this has been written up, Davis writes it up. There are many books written on the emergence of conservative Judaism by Professor Davis. And I think it was 1948 or 47, I may be off by a year, it's not worth checking, Akedekach. But that very year was the year that the Rabbinic Assembly Committee on Jewish Law gave a ruling that it's permissible to use electricity on Shabbat. And that very year, Professor Finkelstein gave the students in the dormitory a Hanukkah gift, time clocks. He heard that boys were turning on and off lights on Shabbos, gave them time clocks. And that captures it. The students, the future rabbis, new world, live up to date. The faculty, Europeish people, Europeans, if not born in Europe, trained by European Rabbanim, children of European Rabbanim, Louis Finkelstein, Abraham Yeshua Heschel, Rav Shaul Lieberman, etc., etc., the Zimitrovsky, you can go one after another. And two different worlds. Now, how does this all come about? The first problems of after World War II, money says it all. Money is honey. Men are refusing to give gittin. Extortion. Schita. They want money. So some of the young rabbis, like some of our people today, learned a little Gemara in their youth, in yeshiva college before they went to the seminary. And they say, Chavkot Kedushin, let's get rid of all these problems. Let us innovate. The rabbis of yore innovated, of yesterday innovated. They came up with retroactive annulment of marriage. Why can't we? I need not tell you, you're dealing with a faculty of some world-class Talmidei Chachamim, Professor Liebman, Professor Schreiber, Professor Dzimitrovsky, you have names and names and names. Alexander Marx, these people were lamdanim. Yes, Havkat Kedushin under certain circumstances at certain times, but it's not a wholesale solution. And there was a lot of quibbling, a little bit of arguing. The topic was raised. No one was more on top of it and had his hand on the pulse than Louis Finkelstein. Professor Louis Finkelstein, who was the chancellor of the seminary by this time, and I happened, what can I tell you? My research on Rabbi Revel, I learned a great deal from Rabbi Louis Finkelstein. I thank him. I made an appointment to meet with him. I'm now dealing with the chapter in the Revel book, and later it's probably the most important postdoctoral research I ever did. It was published by Tel Aviv U and republished in Rakhavet Aharon, the attempt to merge the yeshiva and seminary. So I made an appointment to meet with Professor Finkelstein. Little did I know that the lady who opened the door and welcomed me in, his girl Friday, her daughter would later become my student and marry a student of mine. It's a small world. And I had all these questions for Professor Finkelstein. And he took off his glasses, he looked me right in the eyes, and said to me, Rabbi Rothkopf, you are asking me questions about the 1920s. I was a young student then. I was not privy to any of the information you are asking me about. I will read your manuscript with glee, because after you've done your research, I'm going to learn from you and not vice versa. I'm practically quoting Professor Finkelstein word by word. I have to tell you, he was so honest and so correct. Later in life, did I appreciate that insight? And I always knew when interviewing people, what level to accept their answers on. Is it retrospectively, or did he really live it? And when people interview me, I know exactly where I can be helpful and exactly when I have to say I was in short pants at the time. I can't really answer you honestly. I can only give you my assumption, my guesswork, but I cannot say I'm 100% accurate. Louis Finkelstein had his hand on the pulse. He worshipped the ground that Professor Lieberman walked on. It was said about Louis Finkelstein, I quoted this in lectures decades ago, he believed in God and worshipped Professor Lieberman. And that's a beautiful quote. I need not tell you, Professor Shaul Lieberman, Bucky and Kol HaTorah Kula, Shas and Poskim and Rishalmi and Bavli, Tosefta, Midrashim, and Kulo Halacha. He couldn't tolerate Zohar and Kabbalah, even homiletics, Kulo Halacha. And Professor Finkelstein told him that, I'm quoting from page 47, that even though we're not caught up with the problems that the rabbis face out in the field, but we have to understand that our goal with JTS may be a global epicenter of Jewish scholarship, education, and life, but there are problems out in the field that we are not addressing. Lieberman was very hesitant. He was the happiest person in the world when he was asked by Jerusalem Post, and I quote this in Rakhavet Aharon Chelek Dalet, in my entry in Professor Lieberman, was asked by the Jerusalem Post in the 70s, how did you teach at the seminary? You were Orthodox, they were conservative. One of his answers, and maybe the main answer, was, I could have never done my research without the employment I had there, 2 classes a week and the rest of the time in scholarship. And Finkelstein understood this, and he's saying to Lieberman, yes, we want to be a center of Jewish scholarship, education, and life, but the rabbinical assembly members, our graduates out in the field, have real problems. And Professor Lieberman, I want you to know that they're ready to enact sweeping changes that will endanger Jewish law, fracture Jewish life, and undermine the centrality of JTS. The time has come that we, the faculty, have to intervene. And this is an exact quote from Louis Finkelstein. It's quoted from the JTS archives. This is our last chance to deal with problems of Jewish law effectively in this country. If we cannot find someone within our faculty group who will make the application of Jewish law his life's interest, nothing will prevent incompetent people from undertaking this responsibility. A number of us see the issues raised by the rabbinical assembly as secondary to other vital matters, such as the future orientation of Jews in Israel and America and building up of Torah generally. However, the rabbis who are in congregations cannot take this view and will certainly resent it. And here you have the heart of the conflict. They're not running away from it. Professor Finkelstein is articulating it very clearly. And he's telling this to the man he stands in awe of. This is like, for the sake of argument, some member of the Reitz faculty talking to the Rav and telling off the Rav. He's shaking, but he's telling the Professor Finkelstein, the rabbis out in the field are ready to take action, have cut condition, make fools of us in the eyes of the Rabbanim, in the eyes of Gedolei Yisrael. And remember, Professor Lieberman and Finkelstein had feeling for Gedolei Yisrael, had understanding of Gedolei Yisrael, had understanding, obviously, of the halachic dynamics, the halachic process, and they're willing to abandon it, to negate it, to abrogate it, of God condition. Okay. Professor Finkelstein, in conversation with Professor Lieberman, came up with an idea that they would now have a joint law conference, which would be both faculty and rabbis out in the field. Until now, you had the Committee on Jewish Law. That was Rabbinic Assembly. Now, JTS faculty would descend from the ivory tower to coax the pulpit rabbis towards a less radical resolution. In this way, Finkelstein reasoned, the integrity of halacha would be upheld. And in late 1952, 10 men, 5 from rabbinical assembly and 5 from the JTS faculty, formed a joint committee with a 2-day conference in early 1953 to come up with a solution to them, what they viewed as the most pressing problem, the problem that Balabatim yelled at them, shouted at them, maledicted them. What kind of Judaism are you giving us? A woman who can't remarry this problem must be solved. Who are the 10 men? Here too, it's very interesting. The five members of the rabbinic assembly, rabbis, what they call rabbis, Jacob Agus, recognize the name? That's Jacob Agus of Baltimore. This is a Talmud Mufak of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, a Talmud Mufak of Rabbi Dov Revel, goes on to become a Reconstructionist. This is the brother of Professor Uren Agus of the Bernard Revel faculty. David Aronson is a rabbi, a graduate of the seminary in his own personal life and shown the mitzvot out there in the field, a classic conservative rabbi, not a Reconstructionist. Solomon Goldfarb, recognized the name. He was involved in Chazanah and the Goldfarb family. That's his family. So Shema Shabbos, I'm told, 100% conservative rabbi. Ira Eisenstein, recognized the name. Grandson of the author of the Otze Yisrael, of the various Otzra, Yehuda David Eisenstein, the Lower East Side. This was a grandson. He already was more of a renegade. Who was he married to? The daughter of Mordechai Kaplan. His wife, daughter of Mordechai Kaplan, this is Ira Eisenstein, who later becomes a leader, the leader of the Reconstructionist Society founded by his father-in-law. Solomon Goldfarb, Ira Eisenstein, and Theodore Friedman. Theodore Friedman, of course, I knew very well personally. He was the rabbi in Maplewood, South Orange, the big temple. Conservative, not Reconstructionist. There were two tremendous temples in Maplewood, South Orange. Louis Levitsky was Reconstructionist. Bethel was Rabbi Friedman, and he was hardcore conservative. Went to Yeshivas Elchanan in his youth. He's one of the authors of the responsum that permitted driving in terms of emergency, eight last of Lashem, better they should come to shul. He himself never drove to shul on Shabbos. Jack knows I debated with him, and I won the debate, a kid, and it was all over when I said to him, do you drive to shul on Shabbos? No, you are a Catholic rabbi. I don't know how I had the chutzpah to say that. And he got, what do you mean I'm a Catholic rabbi? Well, the Catholics have different rules for their clergy and for their laity. We Jews are all like rabbis. There's no difference. We all have to observe. If I can't drive, the layperson can't drive. Oh, did I get applause? I came home that night. I think I write about this in Washington. And my wife said to me, you're wasting your time. You stay up late. I think it was a Thursday night. You'd be exhausted. What do you accomplish? And that was, my wife is generally right. That night, she was totally wrong. Why? There was a couple there in their late 20s from Newark, Herbie, who was seeking, searching. And they said that moment in the debate when I said you are a Catholic rabbi, it pushed them into the reality of what Judaism, being a Jew, is about. They were not only to become total shomer Torah mitzvot, settled in Israel, many descendants living on Admat HaKodesh, all going back to the Catholic rabbi comment of some young dummy named Aaron Rothkopf. Okay, so this was the five from the rabbinic assembly. Now from the faculty, Professor, Rabbi, Gong B'Yisrael, Shraga Abramson, Chavruta of Rav David Lipschitz, from Rav Shimon Shkopyet. Number one. Number two, Max Arts. Max Arts was a very powerful conservative rabbi, fabulous speaker, homiletics, darshan, later basically totally on the seminary faculty in the practical rabbinic fields. Judah Golden, a well-known name. His kids went to Ramaz, Shema Mitzvah. He was an expert in Medrash. He published English translations. I believe he translated Ethics of the Fathers, not Pirkei Avot that we have, but the expanded edition that Solomon Schefter put out, two different versions, two different manuscripts of Otter Rabbi Nachman, and he published a whole English translation with commentary. Louis Finkelstein and Shaul Lieberman. So you have here 10 outstanding people, rabbis in the field, both conservative and Reconstructionist, and the heart of the JTS faculty. Max Arts, I can give you a little bit information on. I checked them out. I checked some of these people out, as you will see. But he's a typical story, his years 1897 to 1975. Born in Poland, came to America at the age of 5. And you will see this time and again, that many of the conservative rabbis of that era, could be Orthodox rabbis too, they were all born in Eastern Europe, came to America youngsters, went to yeshiva in their youth in America, be it RJJ or Eitz Chaim, and Chaim Berlin as well, it could be, also existed as an elementary yeshiva. Torah Vadas comes a little bit later, 1918, and all of them conservative rapping it. He was in Stamford, Connecticut. He was in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And 1939, basically joined JTS faculty full time. Now, let me end off. Max Arts, the faculty members were trying desperately to receive acclamation and agreement from the practicing rabbis. And he gives a famous speech at this conference. There are two words in the speech, or it's actually four words, that are quoted and requoted, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, within the conservative movement per se. I quote, "We have to become reconciled to conditions. We cannot apply sanctions. There will always be, quote, victims of the law, end quote. But their number should be reduced." Now, this is the first thing he says, very, very important. What he's saying is there's no panacea. You can't just come about along and say, Hafgad condition will solve every problem. That's what you hear today. It'll solve every problem. A man walks out, a man disappears, a man goes to battle, a man is on a plane, a man on a boat. Hafgad condition. The man became insane. The man became sick. The man became cheap. You find 1,001 different reasons. Hafgad condition. Sounds familiar? Rabbi Rachman's proposal, Rabbi Rachman's Beitin. You can't just do that. There's halacha, there are ways to deal with problems. We can solve most, perhaps we can solve all. There will always be victims of the law. Those words created some very real opposition. Victims of the law? What kind of Torah? Human happiness comes first. Rabbi Hartman telling you in Montreal, Cohen wants to marry a Gioret. Will you be Masada Kedushin? Absolutely. Any Cohen who wants to marry Grusha, Gioret, bring them to me. Personal happiness comes ahead of halacha. You see what's happening here? Art still understood what halacha is about, understood what life is about from a Torah perspective. And finally, and this is historic, we should apply the rule of coercion in a new sense. Have the groom sign an agreement submitting to rabbinical assembly enforcement of marriage and divorce regulations, and use extraordinary pressure of public opinion wherever he refuses to cooperate in issuing a get. And here you hear for the first time of the proposal, we can't do hapkod kedushin, we can't do something wholesale and totally innovative, totally radical, but have the groom sign a statement that he will submit himself to rabbinic assembly rules and regulations. And let us use public opinion that will force him to cooperate and give a get. Okay, here you have that proposal. Notice public opinion. What does it remind you of? Don't we have organizations today that demonstrate outside people's homes? Wasn't Rav Heschel Schachter still very highly involved? Public opinion, public pressure. Fascinating, the words of Max Arts. So let me reiterate. By the way, every word I quoted, when you go to this article, there's sources exactly where he's getting the quotes from. It's either from JTS archives or archives of faculty members or archives of rabbis from rabbinical assembly. And all these archives ultimately wind up at JTS. There are copies of them here at the Hebrew University, but you at the Moshe Davis Institute, the institute that a JTS graduate established, Institute for Modern Jewry, Contemporary Jewry, I think it's called. And the archives are accessible. Now, of course, everything is shut down. It's a different story. But in normal times, a lot of research can be done. You even have here in Israel a total copy. I think it's about 22, 23 volumes of the diary of Mordechai Kaplan. And I told you, the man kept a very careful diary. But unfortunately, they have been able to publish it because they're a little bit hesitant. He was very honest in his diary, and he's called this one an idiot, and this one a nut, and this one a that. And, you know, when we read Zerichen Zich, Shabbos Nachen Kugel, it's enchalant. It's one thing the way you talk, but it's another when you put it into writing. I'm told that is the reason his diaries have not been published, because money is not lacking today. Money could be raised, and he has descendants, whatnot. But they say it would cause so much turmoil that they got to wait another 500 years to see these diaries published. So to reiterate, what have we done today? First of all, I want to thank everyone for coming. Secondly, I want to thank Morty again. Rabbi Rubin called me yesterday and he said, look what Morty's doing for us. I said, all right, I thank him. I thank him again from the bottom of my heart. Baruch Hashem. Mezake et harabim. And so what do we do today? Now we're coming into the real heart of the issue. And if you'll see next week, it's very fascinating. It's literally, we're taking a movie of the spirit, what was going on, these rabbis, what they were thinking. We'll see Rabbi Tenenbaum next week. He stars, and boy, does he open our hearts, our minds, our understanding to this crucial period. But these are the facts. Rabbi Norman Lamb's article, fine, good. The real problem is conservative Beitin. Who are they? They're ruling the world. Okay, the problems within rabbinical assembly and JTS are one of a kind. There's a chasm. Somehow in my days in the yeshiva, 90% of us, of the good fellows who cared, there were a few who went off the path, but 90%, we worshiped the grounds that our rabbeim walked on, even though we couldn't talk baseball with Rav Noach Bunstein, with Yerucham Gerelik, and Rav Leisha Shmuel Volk. Later in life, I told you many times the story with the rabbi, I think I wrote this up too, with Mo Berlin, Zichrono Lebracha, Mo Berlin, when the Rav says to him, Sevishin Minchan Marev, Mo told me it's the day he came in Aliyah, we went to see him, greet him at the Mavaseret Zion Absorption Center, and he says, Ani, I got a good story for you. And he tells me, the Rav said to him, Maisha, explain baseball to me. And he starts explaining to the Rav, first, second, the third, the home run, the comes around, everything with it, and 3 outs. And then it's time to daven. He says, Rebbe, why is this so important to you? And the Rav says, Maisha, don't you understand? My grandchildren are coming for Shabbos. I have to have something to talk about with them. And you know my comment that today, if you lo aleinu, one of those grandsons, you can't ask Hashmoish Hashem, you come to Mo, was killed in the massacre in Hanok. But today, if you'll ask some of them, they'll make believe they never heard of baseball. And I can tell you a fact, when the Boston Red Sox went into the World Series, I think it was, say, you can check it out, 74, and the boys were learning in Brisk in Yerushalayim, the Rav sent a telegram to his grandsons, we won, Zaydi. And that can't be denied, because everyone in Yerushalayim knew about the telegram. Once you tell one, chavre itlay, oh boy, did it spread, the we ecstatic, the Rav is celebrating, the Red Sox won. All right, but the Rav, this Tungaganya, it didn't mean anything but to make his grandchildren happy and make Rakefet sad that they the Yankees lost. But whenever the Red Sox subsequently went into a World Series, you all know I rooted for the Red Sox. And people would say, Rebbe, why? I have a Red Sox hat. My grandson brought me. Why are you wearing the hat? I say, I'm rooting for the Red Sox in honor of the memory of my Rebbe, the Rav. All right, Ad Kan, we'll pick up exactly where we left off. Now, listen very carefully. Next week, Sunday is Yisro Chag. I have the official Red Sox hat. What you have there is just a phony hat. I got to find it. I'll wear it. I'll leave myself a note to wear it next class. Sunday, there's no class. It's Yisro Chag. Pashut Chag ends Saturday night late, and the logistics are too difficult. I've got to catch our breath, and who knows, the Chag, etc. My children are registered for the raffle to get to the Kotel. Let's see what happens. Monday, regular class. Then the next 2 weeks afterwards, regular classes, and that ends this month. It'll be interesting to see if YU, if the kids come in from America, what's going to happen. A lot is happening here. I don't know if you're following the news, but they're opening up Israel to kids coming to study, kids coming to yeshiva seminaries, but they have to go into isolation. I think it's for 14 days or 12 days. There's now a pshat going around that it's only 11 days that the virus stays alive and alert and awake and can harm. So we'll nichye v'nireh. And finally, Morty, the title for today's lecture. What do we want to title? What did we title last week? If we didn't title it with Rabbi Lamb last week, so title this week Rabbi Norman Lamb's critique of the conservative ketubah. Rabbi Norman Lamb's critique of the conservative ketubah. If we used Rabbi Lamb's,
No, we didn't.
Okay, so then that's Rabbi Norman Lamb's critique of the conservative ketubah, and throw it open for questions. Okay.